I did a law degree at university. I stopped law at that point. Lawyers will tell you that the hard work begins then. When they tell me that, I tell them I swapped law for grace. But even law students will have read enough law reports to be bored by them. I mean, they are not normally gripping page turners. On the other hand, we've probably all watched TV legal dramas that have gripped to the end. With so much invested in the outcome, people's hopes and futures, never mind justice itself. Well, here tonight is a law report that reads like a drama, but it is no work of fiction. Tacitus, the well-known first century Roman historian, wrote this. He said, Christus, from whom the name had its origin, Christ, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. Now, John here is writing that history. It's not fiction. He tells of a case with a twist few saw coming, which sucks us into its drama because all our futures hang on it, but it's a case that was real, was recorded. Here are the details of that history. And it's quite some trial. You look at the cast list and there's Pontius Pilate, the procurator, the governor, the judge, a weak man in a position of significant power. There are the Jewish religious leaders who will stop at nothing to get what they want. There's Jesus who's in the dock, but his presence dominates the whole trial. And there's justice. And she's on the cast list and never appears on stage and doesn't have a single line to say. So come and listen in as the case begins with the opening statements. Start at verse 28. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas, the high priest, to the palace of the Roman governor. He's already had intensive questioning from Annas and a mess of a trial with the ruling council, the Sanhedrin, through the night. And by now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they didn't enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. They wanted to play a full part in the continuing Passover celebrations, so they scrupulously observe their religious ritual. But it doesn't, we'll discover, stop them manipulating the proceedings, playing their full part in the greatest of injustices. Minor uncleanness? Couldn't possibly. Turning your back on truth and justice? No scruples at all. Now, what kind of religion is that? Well, verse 29, so Pilate came out to them and asked, what charges are you bringing against this man? It was the standard opening question at any trial. Only Pilate must have known the answer already. The leaders must have talked it through with him when they asked him the night before for a detachment of troops to help arrest Jesus. They're expecting Pilate just to nod it all through, and instead he's starting a fresh hearing. They seem caught out by this in verse 30, don't they? You know, well, if he were not a criminal, they replied, we wouldn't have handed him over to you. Which is a wonderful way to approach any trial if you're looking for justice. Pilate picks up on their vagueness. Pilate said, take him yourself. Judge him by your own law. But we've no right to execute anyone, they objected. Oh, nor you have. Pilate's thinking, you know, you lost that, didn't you, when the occupying troops took over? You need me for that now. You can't help but feel that Pilate is in a grumpy mood throughout the whole proceedings. If he has to come out to them, well, he can make them jump through a few legal hoops and rub their noses in the reminder of his authority as he does it. It is, I guess, the sort of typical sparring between a colonial power and an occupied province. But they can spar as much as they like. They won't change some things. You see, verse 32, this took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. He'd said he would be lifted up. It wouldn't be Jewish Middle Eastern stoning. it would be a Roman execution. And John just slips the line in case we get too enthralled by Pilate and the religious leaders and forget the defendant is actually in control. Well, we move to the heart of the trial, the cross-examination. It starts in earnest now in verse 33. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, asked him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" It's treason he's on trial for. It's a capital charge, but the question is full of contempt, actually. The emphasis is on the "you." You. Are you the King of the Jews? As if Jesus didn't look the part of the wild revolutionary, didn't fit the bill of a rebel threat. "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me?" Jesus seems cautious about answering, doesn't he? It's easy to throw titles around, but people mean different things by them. King? Well, are you thinking military threat? Or Jewish Messiah? "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "Don't expect me to understand. You know, your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it you've done?" Verse 36, Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. I'm not that kind of king. I'm not actually that kind of threat. But now my kingdom is from another place." And as he speaks, Jesus moves the trial away from what is only of interest to an ancient historian. See, it's not about whether he was the pretender to the throne of some minor Roman province. He's a different king with a universal appeal. Pilate's struggling to grasp it. Verse 37, "You are a king then?" And Jesus answered, "You said that I'm a king." He seems to be saying, "Look, it's your word, not mine, Pilate." But yes, and then he explains more of his kingship. You see what he says? It's very striking. "In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. My kingship, my whole raison d'etre, is inextricably linked to the truth." It's got the sense of reality here. Jesus is here, well, to make the reality of God known. "No one has ever seen God," John wrote at the beginning of his book, "but the one and only Son, he has made him known." Jesus is here to make the truth, the reality that rescues, known. "Anyone who commits a sin," he said, "is a slave to sin, but the truth will set you free." Remarkable, isn't it? The prisoner holds out freedom to the judge. And listen to his punchline. Well, look at it there at the end of verse 37. "Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." The truth, the ultimate reality Jesus talks about, see, it's not academic or intellectual. You can't just go to university and learn it. It's moral and spiritual. You have to follow where it leads if you want to know it. You have to listen and obey the one who is the truth. Do you listen to Jesus? Or does something other than truth and reality rule you? You've got to say yes to one question or the other. Suddenly Pilate, who thought he was asking the questions, finds himself on the back foot. "What is truth?" retorted Pilate. You know, is that a postmodernist question? Is Pilate ahead of his time? Could be a philosophical question. What is truth? Could be a roll your eyes, shrug your shoulders question. What's truth? It's certainly an exit line. If it was a serious question, he's not going to follow through on it. He asks the question and, you notice, then leaves. What is truth? Pilate retorted. With that, he went out again to the Jews gathered there. He's not stopping to listen to an answer. He's certainly not listening to Jesus. Well, he delivers his verdict. Verse 38, I find no basis for a charge against him. And if truth shapes that verdict, Pilate's grip on it is very weak. Because integrity would demand he release the prisoner if he's innocent. And Pilate wants others to make that call. Look at verse 39. But it's your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the King of the Jews? And Pilate knows just how to wind them up, doesn't he? The deal is, I release one prisoner. The deal is, I give you one get-out-of-jail-free card. Now, shall I use it on a prisoner I've found innocent? They shouted back. They screamed back. No, not him. Give us Barabbas. Now, Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. Barabbas was a terrorist. Here's hypocrisy too, isn't there? One moment you demand he condemns Jesus, falsely accused as a danger to Rome. Next moment you demand he releases Barabbas, convicted of being a terrorist against Rome. What is truth? Well, neither Pilate nor the religious leaders are living any kind of answer to that question. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. They're not listening to anyone. They're too busy shouting to hear Jesus, to face reality. So we head to the verdict. Oh, yeah, it's going to be a long time before it's actually delivered, but people have shown their true colors already. Pilate is weak. The leaders are ruthless. There's only going to be one outcome, however tortuous the route, and tortuous is the word for the prisoner. You see how chapter 19 begins. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. Of course, just what you do with someone you think's innocent. Although, it actually turns out to be Pilate's next desperate strategy to get Jesus released. He's flogged, he's brutalized, he's made the butt of crude, cruel, barrack room humor in verses 2 and 3. And then Pilate declares him innocent again, parades Jesus in front of them, declaring, dripping with sarcasm, I think, here is the man. Big threat, says Pilate, as Jesus is exposed, scarred, bloodied, weak, weary. But there's no sympathy, never mind mercy, in the priest's heart. See how they respond? As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, crucify, crucify. They want blood. They won't stop until they get it. It's religion at its ugliest. Well, Pilate again protests Jesus' innocence, but the stakes are raised further with the claim that he's broken Jewish blasphemy laws and has claimed to be the Son of God. And verse 8, another striking line, when Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid. He's been uncomfortable all along. And now there's talk of gods of some kind involved. He may be the superstitious pagan, but he lived within a god or a gods, a culture. And it unnerves him. And Jesus doesn't help him. Do you see that in verse 9? Where do you come from? He asked Jesus. You know, earth or heaven? But Jesus gave him no answer. Pilate's already shown he won't listen to or follow the truth, so Jesus doesn't answer that kind of questioner. Herod couldn't get a word out of him either, but then Herod just wanted a show, not the truth. Pilate still clinging to his sense of power, verse 10, don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you? I represent Caesar, the greatest power on earth. Bullies like to flaunt their power, don't they? Jesus is unimpressed. You see his answer in verse 11? You'd have no power over me if it were not given you from above. Actually, your power comes from my Father. Which is why Caiaphas has even more responsibility and guilt, because he, Caiaphas, is meant to know and teach and do the will of God, that Father. Well, rather like a fish thrashing the water long after it's well and truly hooked, Pilate tried to set Jesus free in verse 12, but he can't cope with the screaming Jewish leaders. If you let this man go, you're no friend of Caesar. Which may just be a true statement, you're not an ally of him. It is just possible that friend of Caesar was a sort of honorific title. You know, FOC, friend of Caesar, rather like we have medals, OBE, Order of the British Empire. You know, you go down this route, Pilate, you'll lose your medal. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. What would Rome make of it if you, Pilate, released a claimant to the throne of Judah? I mean, think of intelligence services today and the fuss if they'd had a terrorist under arrest and then released him before he committed some terrible atrocity. Even Pilate knows the game's up. So in verse 13, Jesus and the judgment seat are brought out. There's one last hopeless attempt that's made. Verse 15, shall I crucify your king? We have no king but Caesar, the chief priests answered. I mean, there seems no end to their newfound and short-lived loyalty to Caesar. No end to the depths of hypocrisy they'll plunge to. And so finally, verse 16, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. He throws in the towel. This is the verdict. Pilate handed him over. And I just pause there because Pilate is the great warning to all of us who think we can sit on the fence over Jesus. No one does the fence sitting better than Pilate. Four times he declares Jesus innocent. Six times he tries to release him and get him off his hands without actually doing it. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. At last he did get Jesus off his hands, washed his hands of him. But you can't. History's verdict is clear, isn't it? The one thing above all others we know about Jesus, we've said it already tonight. Jesus Christ suffered, crucified under Pontius Pilate. And the twist in the story? It's not last-minute evidence. It's not last-minute rescue. Justice is still waiting in the wings when the curtain falls. The twist is that as his enemies conspire to destroy Jesus, all they do is actually the making of him. Look, one of the things John does quite frequently is to leave in his account lines where someone has spoken far truer than they knew. You know, Caiaphas saying, it would be good if one man died for the people is one example. From Pilate, I think it's this one. Here is the man. Here is the man. For Pilate, he says it full of irony. What a wreck of a human being. What a parody of a king. Here's the man. For John, oh no, here is the man. A real man. And his suffering is his appeal. Jesus has been through it. The physical battering, the abuse. He was violated. He is the God of the abused. I was on the phone last week to one of those who suffered the alleged abuse of the Christian lawyer, John Smythe, QC. He was telling me something of what he'd been through. Told me that, as far as he was aware, there were only two, possibly three of them who had any faith left now. And having talked with him, I started looking at this trial, and part of my mind was wondering what had held him and kept his faith. And as I read and I saw, here's Jesus beaten even more severely than those teenagers were. This is the God for the abused. Physical, emotional, the mockery and the ridicule. Here is the man, on top of all the pain he's been through, he's presented as a grotesque figure with a tattered robe and a weird spiky headdress, more clown than king, as someone put it. Bruce Milne writes, "That touches us deeply, for there's almost nothing we dread more than being thought ridiculous. Most people, in fact, are much more ready to be thought bad than silly. Nothing so readily penetrates the armor of our self-esteem than mocking laughter. Yet it was with precisely that ringing in his ears from the soldiers' ridicule that Jesus appeared for the further mockery of the crowd. He was despised, and we esteemed him not," as Isaiah wrote. We hate mockery and shame, don't we? Who else has a God who knows what that feels like? You know, others rush to point to the strength and the power of their God. Ours knows weakness. At the lowest of times, he is still God with us. A real man who knows real suffering. And a representative man whose death is our rescue. See, he's fully human to be our representative. And Jesus stood trial as a blasphemer and as a traitor. And sin leaves us all looking like that too. Blasphemer, because the heart of sin is to play God in his world. You'll be like God, the tempter said. And it's why we do it. And traitor? Well, because to sin is to rebel against God's rule. And there'll come a day when a far greater judgment seat than Pilate's will be in front of us. The judgment seat of God. And the charges against us on that day will be just the ones Jesus faced that we lived as blasphemers and as traitors. And our only hope, our sure hope, is that Jesus stands before that judgment seat as our representative, facing our charges, standing in our place, having borne our judgment. God for us. If you've stopped trying to get Jesus off your hands, if you've stopped trying to hand him over to someone who will take him out of your life, if you've stopped trying to sit on the fence that doesn't exist about Jesus, if you've identified with him, embraced him as the one to represent you, well, then you'll be glad to say, "Man of sorrows, what a name for the Son of God who came ruined sinners to reclaim. Hallelujah. What a Savior.